Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. This is Bonnie Kay, and welcome to the Straight Wives Talk Show. This is a hard-hitting show that discusses the complexities of marriages between straight women to gay men. Each week, my guests and I discuss issues that affect over 4 million women in this country and millions more around the world who find themselves unknowingly married to a gay or bisexual man. Tonight, I have a very special guest, and we would like to say a couple of words before we talk about her wonderful work. I'd like to introduce Dr. Marie Hartwell Walker. Marie, thank you so much for joining me tonight on the show.
I'm very happy to be here, Bonnie. Thank you for inviting me.
And before I introduce you, we were talking a little bit about we'd like to make a joint statement together about our tremendous sorrow over the events that have happened today, June 12th.
I wanted to emphasize that the incidents in Orlando today only underline why so many gay men are still closeted. It's a very frightening event, and it shows yet again that we have not evolved as far as we'd like to think we have in terms of accepting people in all their variety. And I just want to express my condolences and my very deep sadness to all the families who are suffering so much tonight.
And I certainly would like to express my sadness for the whole situation in general, that you would think that even though people think that we're progressing as far as our views on homosexuality, that it only takes one incident like this to really set things back. And it's so sad to me that in this day and age that people still can't be who they are because of the fact of the repercussions that are brought about. And a lot of times, you know, women say to me, I don't understand why gay men still get married. Today it's out there, it's open, you could be free to be gay. And maybe you can in some places when you live in a big city, but when you're living in middle America, it's still not an accepted thing, and people still feel they want to try not to be something that people look on very poorly, as you can see from the incident today, through fanaticism and hatred and just blind rage, terrible things happen. So hopefully these families, I don't know how you ever reconcile something like this. I don't even have any words of comfort because I don't think there are any at a time like this. So all we can do is just send our love, right?
That's very honest. There really are no words. But all we can do is share some deep feelings and hope for the future.
And hopefully, once again, tomorrow's a new day. Nothing's going to drastically change, but maybe people can start taking a deeper breath and start looking at the causes of all of this hatred around the world. It just seems, even in last night, that young girl was killed singing on stage in Orlando, Florida. Did you hear about that news?
Yes, I did. As far as I know, nobody yet knows why.
Craziness.
It is. And
very sad. Again, all I can say is I'm really glad I'm older and didn't grow up in today. My one comfort of getting old, that I was able to grow up in a much more innocent time, I think.
Well,
but getting
I
back to our show.
I must be older than you because I was at 6 years old ducking under my desk because of the threat of nuclear war. Okay. Well,
I always tell that to my students on our social studies lessons, how they used to have the air raid drills. And they'd make us go in the hallways and put our heads between our legs. That's going to save us from the nuclear war. But those were scary days
again,
also.
I think any actions like that are intended to give us a sense of control when we are out of control. And that's all it does.
So let's talk a little bit about you and your work tonight.
Pardon me?
I'd like to tell people how I was lucky enough to track you down to come onto the show. I often receive articles from members of our Straight Wives Club, articles that are inspiring and helpful, that give women strength, and our women are always looking for articles to help other women as far as narcissism, sociopathy. It could be from borderline personalities to passive aggressiveness, all kinds of, you know, disorders and behaviors. And a lot of times these articles are extremely helpful. But one that was sent to me a few months ago that I just was in awe of was an article that you wrote. And it's called Why Women Stay in Control with Controlling Men. And it's not that I haven't read many articles. It's just that none of them seem to pinpoint it just the way you did so perfectly. And I did take the opportunity a few months ago to even discuss this with one of my other guests, your article. But this is even better because here's the author of the article. So if you don't mind, I'd like to go through it a little bit with you.
Sure.
Because this certainly does apply to a lot of the women that are part of our network.
Yeah, the reason I wrote this article, Bonnie, was, as you know, I'm also a practicing psychologist. And I was I was just struck by how many women were continuing to blame themselves for having fallen into and stayed in painful relationships. And as I thought about it, I just wanted to give people something to hold on to, that, A, you're not alone if you found yourself in that kind of situation, but there are really good reasons for making bad choices. People are not crazy for making very painful choices, that it's, especially when someone is feeling very vulnerable, they can be pulled into situations that then become more and more painful for them.
And I think a lot of times when we're younger, it's easier to be misled into these situations because we don't have the information. And I think when we're younger, the excitement of that bad boy type of personality seems real appealing when you're 20, 22, 24, and you haven't had experience in relationships. And these guys are just so good. And I just want to read a little bit of this, and then we can discuss it by the points that you brought in. But
sure.
Dr. Walker wrote, why would a woman stay in a relationship with a guy who puts her down, hems her in, and perhaps even physically abuses her? Why would a woman hold down two jobs to keep the rent paid and the food on the table while her boyfriend sits around smoking weed all day? Why, oh, why would a woman allow herself to be emotionally blackmailed by her boyfriend's threats that he will kill himself or her or both if she even talks about leaving a relationship that is going nowhere? There's no easy answer. Often it's a complicated mix of a number of answers. If you wonder why on earth you stay with the guy who keeps hurting you in spite of the promises to do better, in spite of protestations that he loves you, in spite of your own obvious distress about how things are going, see if you recognize yourself in any of these common reasons. But please be careful not to jump to conclusions based on a list. It's not at all uncommon for relationships to have some challenging times. Reasons for staying become problems when they become excuses or ways we fool ourselves into believing that things aren't that bad when in fact they are. If you keep getting hurt, if you know in your heart that the relationship is diminishing you, but you still keep going back for more, then it may be time for you to get into therapy or to find the resources in your community to help women extricate themselves from controlling or abusive relationships. So here are the 8 bad reasons, and I'm going to, you know, state them, and then maybe you could talk a little bit about them. So
sure.
Reason number one is because being someone's everything is intoxicating stuff, at least at first.
Well, you mentioned young people who are 20 and 22 and 24. Some of the people I see in bad relationships are 16 and 17 and 18 or have been in relationships since they were 16, 17, 18. So talk about being too young to have enough experience to make a good choice. We are inundated in our culture with this idea of romantic love, that real love is you are somebody's everything. And when you met, the person only had eyes for you. They wine you and dine you, or at least pizza and beer you. The man in your life calls you every morning to tell you he loves you, meets you for lunch, is there when you get off from work, and you are his everything. And it, especially if a young woman, even an old woman, I'll speak for myself, even if a woman has low self-esteem herself, to have somebody put her up on a pedestal like that is really intoxicating stuff. But if the guy is so insecure that he needs control, that attention starts to become what I called it hemming you in. You can't move. Because now, if when he shows up after work, you want to go out with your office mates for dinner, now the look of betrayal crosses his face, and then there's an argument, and then there's a fight of how could you? If you really loved me, you would be home. And this kind of behavior increases over time until the woman in question can't go anywhere by herself, make a phone call without it being interrogated. So being somebody's everything can become extremely limiting and being really controlled by another person.
Right. And I think sometimes when you're younger, you can confuse that because you're so happy someone loves you so much, not realizing
right.
they just want to take over your life.
That's
so then
right.
you have, because these guys can be absolutely charming. And I think that
yeah,
is so true.
I think that's a really important point. Again, women in my office might say, what happened? He was Prince Charming. He said all the things I wanted to hear. He was really sweet to me. And I wanted to emphasize that women aren't stupid for falling in love with someone who's so lovable. Because, again, especially someone with a narcissistic personality disorder can be extremely charming. And again, this can be a way of ultimately being in control, because then if you question anything, he acts so hurt that you could even think that he might do or say something. Very good with words sometimes, very, very good with words. Now, one of the things I wanted to emphasize, Bonnie, is nobody does all of these things all of the time. Some people have, as we go through this list, some men have one or more of these strategies. Some have a little bit of all of them. It's not intended to be a diagnostic criteria. It's simply to give people a way, women a way to say, oh, yeah, that fits, or a piece of that fits, okay?
And definitely if you match all of them, you're in trouble. All right,
oh,
here we have, because you don't know any better. Now, I think this is really true. All the women you grew up with are in abusive, difficult relationships, and all your girlfriends complain about men who don't do their share, who stopped being Mr. Wonderful long ago, and lacking role models or positive, loving relationships. You think good relationships only happen in the movies. Oh, I just love when you said that there, Marie, because it's so true. If you have nothing to role model, I don't have role models that have positive relationships, you think a negative relationship is the way of the world, right?
Right, and, you know, there's an old cliche that birds of a feather flock together. There's more truth to that than I wish were the case. Often, young women who are feeling, again, being in a controlling relationship, will look for affirmation from other girls who are in similar relationships. And this can become kind of contagious because we all need to be affirmed in what we're seeing. So if I'm not feeling good about myself and I feel I only deserve the crumbs from the table, then I'm going to find other people who say, oh, yeah, I feel that way too. Because that's a way to feel better, believe it or not. If I can't feel really good, I want to at least feel that my lot is no worse than anybody else's.
Now, the next one is really true also. In these relationships, once you're in them, you write, because he scares you or manipulates you. There are men who aren't a bit subtle about their need for control, try to leave, and they threaten to hurt you or your kids or other people you care about. He may have even grabbed you too hard or hit you or locked you in the room or waved a gun around. When he goes into a rage, there's no telling what he might do, so you do everything you can to prevent it, including staying. It's really interesting you said that because I had a young woman who, you know, I've worked with on several different things, projects, including a book that she's writing. And she talks about her sister who was in exactly this kind of relationship, and every time she wanted to leave, the guy would threaten he's going to kill her or put a gun to her head. And she stayed much longer, getting beat up and everything else, and eventually she finally found the courage to leave. And a year later, he walked into a room where she was and convinced her to go have a talk with him. And he put the gun right in her face and murdered her right there. So you're right, these men will do anything. And he only served 8 years in jail. Can you believe it?
Unfortunately,
this is in Alabama.
Maybe this is a good place to insert some information, Bonnie.
Mm-hmm.
In this kind of situation, if a woman feels is truly afraid for herself, afraid for her children, there is help out there. There's a national resource center on domestic violence, and you can find them at a website, www.ncdsv, National Center for Domestic Violence.org. And the phone number is 800-537-2238. That's 800-537-2238. Now, my disclaimer there is I have no formal association with the center at all. I found them on the web, and I have been in touch with them, but I'm not in any kind of formal relationship with them. I think it's really important for women to feel like there is somebody who will know how to help them. And another very important warning here is if you are in a violent relationship and you are truly afraid, do not use your cell phone or your computer to contact the Center for Domestic Violence. Go to the library, go to a friend's, because I'll tell you, a man who is this violent, if he discovers that you've tried to get help, he's going to get more violent, and your life can be in danger. So do not use your own cell phone. Do not use a computer where he can track your activity. Find a way to use some other device so that you can't be tracked.
And that's exactly what happened to this young lady. He checked her cell phone when she said, no, I wasn't talking to my family, and then he grabbed her cell phone, and he saw she was talking to the family. So
and
these
then
guys,
he gets righteous and says, "You lied to me," and gets fired.
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly. And then he beat her and said, "Well, you deserved it for lying to me."
Right.
My heart goes out, and I tell this to women, and maybe you can just reiterate this. I didn't understand abuse when I was younger, before, you know, I went to school and learned about it. And I think a lot of people are very judgmental, especially with physical abuse. And they say, well, how is it she could stay with him? Why is she letting herself get beat up? And I used to think that also. I used to think, well, there must be something wrong with her. She keeps going back, not having the knowledge or the understanding of how debilitating and how frightening this is. And when you meet these guys, these are not guys who you go out with on your first date, and at the end of the date they go and they slap you in the face. I mean, if that were the case, then chances are you would never see them again. But these guys are smart, and they know how to get you to fall in love with them. And it doesn't start off with a beating. Am I right?
You certainly are. And we're actually looping back to some of the things we already talked about. Often the man in question has very low self-esteem himself. And in order to feel like a man among men, he needs to feel that he's at least better than somebody else. I mean, there are two ways to deal with low self-esteem, right? You either elevate yours or you feel better than somebody else. It's much easier to feel better than somebody else than to do your own personal work. So we often have men who feel actually quite scared, quite vulnerable. Their self-esteem is quite low. And the way they feel... they puff themselves up is to have some sense of superiority in their own home. And this can be quite dangerous. The other reason women often stay is sometimes after one of these rageful blowouts, the man reverts to the charming Mr. Wonderful for a while. He apologizes, he brings flowers, he says, "It'll never happen again, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry." And if you couple that with a woman who has low self-esteem, who maybe thinks nobody else will have me except this guy, and it looks like it's going to get better, they get sucked back in, and then the cycle starts all over again. I want to also add, Bonnie, the other piece of this is that men who are in abuse, who are abusers, don't always get violent. Sometimes they're manipulators. And that's what I call emotional blackmail. If you leave me, I will die. If you leave me, I will end my life. And now he's making the woman responsible for whether he lives or dies. Who wants that? So,
and unfortunately, that does happen quite a bit. We've had a number of women in our support network who are exactly in that situation where the husbands do tell them that if you leave me, I'm going to kill myself. And they manipulate them into staying there, and of course, the tragedy is that it only takes one to do it that makes everybody else feel, well, maybe I am responsible. And of course, I try to tell them that, you know, they can't take responsibility for this. You can't let somebody keep you in a situation you don't want to be with because you have to worry if they're going to take their life. Then you have to say, well, then I need to get help for you. Then, you know, if you're thinking about suicide, then it's really important you get mental health help, and I'll be happy to help you do that or call someplace and say that he's threatening himself. But you can't let yourself be manipulated in that way. But I also think that a lot of it goes back to – I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I think it's important, for women to know they can turn that responsibility over to someone else. The choices are not either I have to rescue him or he dies. The third alternative is turn that responsibility over to someone else. Take him to the crisis team. Get him into therapy. If he won't go to therapy, that's okay. You go to therapy and talk about him. And by the way, most of these men can't stand it that their wife or girlfriend is going to therapy, and they want to go and straighten the therapist out about whose fault it really is. So often that's often how I finally get to see the men, is that they come in to set me straight. And then it's my job as a therapist to find a way to help them see that they have something to gain by staying in therapy, either as a couple or initially or as an individual. But women do not have to take that responsibility. The alternative is not that the person will be a successful suicide. As you said, some of these men do make suicidal gestures. There are accidental suicides where someone just wanted to bleed and make you feel bad. But again, that's then the work that comes the way of you and me, where we work with the woman to get through that trauma of feeling like she was somehow responsible. She is never responsible.
Exactly. The next reason that you have on your list, I think, really plays into the previous reason, is because you really believe you can change him. And I think this is a big problem for the women that I work with. We really go into these marriages. Yeah, I'm sorry.
No, I was affirming what you said, especially for women who have been essentially pulled into a marriage that's based on a lie to begin with.
Exactly.
And then, and then they are actually asked, begged, pleaded with, or threatened that you have to help me stay straight or act as if I'm straight or get straight, whatever the man's position is on that. And because he could be so charming and because maybe the woman's self-esteem isn't great to begin with, then it's again, feeling responsible for someone else's life and choices and trying to be the agent of change. Well, again, you don't have to do that. There are therapists who'd be happy to do that. You don't have to do that on your own.
And in these situations, especially if you know your husband's gay, there is nothing to change. Because the fact is that you cannot change his sexuality. And no, I think for women, I'll tell you why it's so confusing for our women, Marie. It's because when they get married, their husbands promise to love and cherish them forever. And they have some good years in many cases. They have children together. They start building a life together. They're having some sexual activity in the beginning anyway, you know, until it gets impossible for the man to do it. And the woman can't understand, why did we have 10 good years? Why did we have 15 good years and now all of a sudden they're not there? And, of course, naturally the tendency is for us to try to do better and try to be better wives and try to make them happier because something we're doing is failing because we don't necessarily know the truth. You know, they're keeping that missing puzzle piece from us from figuring that out. But even once we find out the truth, then we think, well, can't they change?
If the man in question starts giving you all kinds of reasons why it is your fault. You've gained too much weight. You're not sociable enough. You don't make me laugh. There are all kinds of ways that a woman's self-esteem can be undermined to the point where she believes that it's all my fault. Now, one of the things that we haven't talked about, Bonnie, is believing it's all my fault actually can make someone feel better. Because if it's all my fault, then maybe I can do something to make it better. If I accept that it's not my fault, that this is the guy's issue, then there's nothing I can do. And that can feel even worse than feeling that it's my fault.
It's That's really amazing. I never thought of that.
Being between a rock and a hard place. So that's part of what therapy can help a woman with, is it isn't one of those two things. Therapy, as you know, what therapy is often about is introducing new alternatives. That it's not either your fault or not your fault. You know, it's not either you're in control by believing it's your fault and therefore if only you could find the right button to push, everything will be fine again, right? Or the fellow making the guy saying, "Well, it is all your fault now, so that you can feel worse about yourself, so that you'll stay." There are many other alternatives, and of course, those are as individual as the people who I'm talking to.
And then you talk about you're more afraid of being alone again than of being in a painful relationship. That is just so true for so many people. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Well, we live in a culture that doesn't celebrate singlehood very well. That's beginning to change, by the way, with the millennials. But for those who are older, being alone can seem terrifying, especially if they never were alone. Again, I've been in my practice, it's not unusual for me to be talking to someone who's been in a 10 and 15 year relationship that started when she was 15. And so she doesn't know anything else. And she looks at the dating scene and it's terrifying. The other reality is that women usually come out poorer and in worse shape after a divorce than the men do. Now they've got children to support. We still live in a culture where men are more likely to slide out of a lot of responsibility for the kids. And so now we have a single woman trying to support herself, take care of her kids, manage a household, do well in a job. Maybe she was really financially dependent on the guy, and then the child support stops. Again, women aren't crazy for being afraid of this. It's very scary. It can be, they can be helped through it. They can be helped to get on their feet. But I imagine for many women, when they look at a life that where they've been a stay-at-home mom particularly, or they've had the minor job of the two, to think about, okay, what do we do if we divorce? What kind of financial shape am I going to be, and how am I going to manage all this? It's terrifying. Not to mention getting back in the dating scene, which is also terrifying.
It is. But I think a lot of our women get to the point where they realize that you can be more lonely living with someone than you can be living yourself by yourself. The loneliness that comes from being in a relationship where you're rejected sometimes is even more overwhelming. But I do see women say they're afraid, they haven't been alone. And so a lot of our women went from their homes where they grew up right into their marriages without having
exactly.
any space in between.
Exactly.
And it is scary if you never lived alone, right?
Of course it is. Of course it is. And one of the things that I certainly try to do, and I imagine you do too, is help women in that situation see it as a growth opportunity rather than only as a scary time in life, that by going straight from the home they grew up in into an unsatisfying marriage, they never gave themselves the time to get their own feet under them. And it can be very exciting.
Well, we try to give all the encouragement and support to women who need to be out, you know, remaking their life again. And we have so many happily ever after stories that I'm always so excited that we have women giving support who are in that situation. One of the last points you bring out, and I think it's just really hits the nail on the head, you stay because you love him. And you said it's the most common answer you get when I ask women why they want to stay in a bad relationship is because I love him. And love isn't always rational. There's no accounting for chemistry. But the fact is that love, especially one-sided love, isn't enough to sustain a relationship. It's like one hand clapping. And that
is
so true, right?
It is. I don't know if I can enlarge that on that or say it any better, Bonnie. One of my clients said to me once that I said in the article, it's like one hand clapping. Here's another analogy. It's like putting your hand out for a handshake and the other person never takes it. And then your hand is just hanging out there and you feel more and more foolish and you keep reaching and reaching because at one time the partner did hold your hand, or at least for a while, or once in a while. But when you just keep putting yourself out there and all the love in the world isn't going to make the other person reciprocate. That's
exactly.
very, very hard. That's rejection on top of rejection, and that's what strips away people's self-esteem. I think that's as devastating to a woman as the lack of sex in her marriage is the lack of reciprocal love. So, yeah, people don't want to
believe
it.
Some of it is tied in together also. And I want to mention to our listeners that Dr. Hartwell Walker is licensed as both a psychologist and marriage and family counselor. And you've been working with people for over 40, for about 40 years now, and you've seen so much of this in your practice, right?
Absolutely. You know, we live in a culture where, although actually the divorce rate is declining a little bit over the last few years, the fact is it's still somewhere between 45% and 48% of first marriages end in divorce. What I don't know, and maybe you do, is how many of those divorces are due to either domestic violence and or domestic violence that has its, or domestic violence or rejection that has its roots in a hidden sexuality. Do you have that data?
I don't, and I don't think it's the majority of the divorces. I just feel the majority of divorce, why it's so different today than when we were growing up.
Absolutely.
Is that the expectations from life are so different. I have a friend whose daughter just, she came home one day and just said, I'm leaving my marriage of 30-some years. I met somebody, and I want to be happy. Or
right.
You have people all of a sudden that, you know, got married young, and when you're in your 20s, it's different today than it was when we were in our, well, maybe not that much different, but when like our parents were in their 20s. And the expectations were different. You know, women are in the workforce today. They're, you know, doing so many different things with children. It's not like you're just sitting home. Not that sitting home is just sitting home, but you're doing so, you're multitasking all day long. And
more women,
if somebody doesn't grow with you, I think it's really hard to keep couples together.
And I do think one of the positives is, even though I don't want to imply or state that all divorce is bad. I think sometimes it's the healthiest thing.
No, I think it's good. I think it's healthy. I think
and
that if people can't make it and they're not happy together, then they need to find other alternatives.
And women have
I grew up in a family where people tried to stay together for a long time and they were miserable. And as a result, we were all miserable. And you know, like Dr. Phil always says, you know, it's better to come from a broken family than to be in a broken family. And I really agree with that, that if people are just not making it, or the love isn't there, or the feelings aren't there, and they try to work it out, you know, what are you willing to, you know, I hate to use this word, but settle for in life, or do you want something more? You know, you have to be happy. I think that has to come first.
Well, I will make a pitch for therapy.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely.
Okay. And of course, if there's abuse in a relationship, then one should just push the eject button and get out as fast as you can and run for your life. But if things have just gone from wonderful and sort of declined and you're not happy anymore, I would always rather see people in the therapy office before they go to the lawyer's office, because sometimes it's a matter of taking a new look at yourself and each other, and those relationships can, in fact, rebound. But, you know, it's very complicated. It's very complicated.
It really is, and it takes a lot of work. But there are some wonderful therapists out there that can really help you and get you on the right track. A lot of people really are committed to their marriages, and they're just looking to really find ways to improve them. People don't go in looking for a divorce. You know, they're looking to stay together. That's what marriage is supposed to be about. And it's good to have the alternative if it's not working out. But if it can work out, certainly. Therapy is wonderful.
And sometimes it's only when one or the other starts talking about separating that it's a wake-up call for both, that maybe they should do something before going to the lawyers.
But it does have to be a willingness for both of them, correct?
I didn't hear you, please.
I said it does have to be a willingness on both of their parts, right?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. At least a willingness to give it a shot. There's no point in coming to a therapist's office just to say you did. I mean, there are people who do that. They come into my office, and I know that one of them is there just to appease the other or to be able to say to the lawyer, well, we tried.
Well, I went for therapy, right, exactly.
Right. They didn't try. Doing therapy requires a willingness to engage and to persist a bit.
And
then part of my job is to find out whether there's reason to try.
That's it. So let's talk about your book, Unlocking the Secrets of Self-Esteem, which is a book that whether you believe it or not, I believe everybody needs this book. Whether you think you have good self-esteem or you don't, you still need to read this book because you'll have better self-esteem when you finish reading it. And I'm going to tell you what I love about your book as
okay.
much as what I loved about your article.
Can
a lot
you
of
see
times
me blushing
people talk
already?
About, huh?
I said, can you see me blushing? But thank you.
Yeah, a little bit, but it's true. A lot of people
okay.
can write about self-esteem, but you not only write about it, but you give concrete suggestions step by step on what to do to rebuild it or to build it. And I think that's the key that's missing from a lot of books. They may give some suggestions, but you approach it totally from another point of view altogether. I mean, from several different points of view. So I'd like to talk about some of the aspects. And for people who, once again, are listening to this show, the book is called Unlocking the Secrets of Self-Esteem. And if you go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble,
yeah,
and you'll
and
see.
Yeah, and it's put out by New Harbinger Press. And what I'd like people to know who haven't seen the book before, Bonnie, is this is a workbook.
Mm-hmm.
It has lots of activities, exercises, self-assessment tools. It is meant to be not just a book to read and think about, but it's a doing book. And so what people have told me is that's one of the things that's valuable about it, because it's one thing to read something. It's another thing to read, think about it, and have to fill in some blanks, because now you're more actively involved with what you're reading.
Exactly. And that's why I say this book is so great, because there's so many great ways to start looking at things differently. I've learned a lot from this book, and I'm always interested in issues of self-esteem. I always said that, and I tell this to people all the time, that if I had the option, if somebody could say, here's $1 million, do whatever you want for the rest of, well, the rest of a few years, I used to be for the rest of my life, I would spend that money just studying self-esteem, because it just is something to me that's so fascinating to see how it can, you know, affect each person. And I'll tell you one thing that I learned when I was younger, and I think maybe you could concur with this, is that when I was growing up, you always had the girls in school who were the pretty girls and the cheerleaders types. And, you know, I was certainly never one of them. I was always one of the gawky girls or the chunky girls. And, you know, when you're not one of the beautiful people, you're always in awe looking at them and thinking, boy, I wish I was living their life. And as I got older, of course, then I realized that all that glitters isn't necessarily gold. And I used to meet people as I got older who were beautiful people on the outside, but their self-esteem was even much worse than mine was, you know, on the inside. And so it's really not about a matter of how you look outside. It's all about how you feel inside. And I think that was a big lesson for me to learn when I was younger, that it wasn't just about how you look, it's about how you feel. And that
Absolutely.
There are a lot of people who look good, but they don't feel good. Is that correct?
Absolutely. And one of the difficulties in, for the beautiful people of the world is that they begin to think that their currency is only their looks. And as you know, looks fade. And then if you were, if all of your self-esteem was based on being the prettiest person in the room, and you're no longer the prettiest person in the room, then you're bankrupt. So the same thing, by the way, is true of people who inherit a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
I've had many young clients like this because of the area I live in, people who have enormous trust funds and who are always wondering whether their success is attributable to something they really did or they were just lucky.
Uh-huh.
And it undermines their own confidence in themselves.
So if you had to start at the beginning, if you were defining self-esteem to somebody who really didn't know much about it and saying, boy, you know I don't feel good about myself and I just don't feel like I'm good enough. And what is self-esteem anyway? What would you tell them?
Well, I would first, in the most gentle way possible, ask them what they've done to deserve feeling good about themselves.
Uh-huh.
We are currently still reverberating from a cultural mistake. I really believe that, where we thought that feeling good about oneself was so important that we were going to do everything possible to make people feel good. Well, we somehow lost sight of a very important part of the self-esteem equation. If you go back to the beginnings of, and this is one of the things that I did while I was writing this book, is I went back and researched, okay, what is this thing called self-esteem and what have people said about it? If you go back to the beginning researchers, they were looking at a two-part definition of self-esteem. And it's a what's called a recursive loop, meaning that it goes around and around and around. To feel good about yourself, you have to do things that in your heart you believe are worthy of feeling good about yourself. And if you do things that make you feel like you're worthy of feeling good about yourself, you will feel good about yourself, which then gives you the strength and energy to continue doing things that are worthy of feeling good about yourself. Did I explain that well?
You did a really good job.
It goes around and around.
A little dizzy, but you did a great job on that.
Okay, so
one
of the things I looked at was some of the research that had been done in the wake of all of this feel-good definition that we've been held by over the last, say, 30 or 40 years. And one of the most startling things I found was a study that was done. There's something called retrospective studies, where there's a study of all the studies. And a researcher did a study of 15,000 studies that attempted to show that feeling good about yourself would improve your grades, make you a better wife or a husband, that would make you more successful in business, you name it, would make you good at something. And what he found in all of those studies was that feeling good about yourself by itself does nothing to make you more successful. Nothing, zero. Isn't that extraordinary?
Yeah.
It's nothing. The reason being that you can feel really good about yourself and do really bad things. Sociopaths feel really good about being able to pull things over on people. Right? So feeling good isn't enough. It is, and what's been happening since the mid-90s is that people are looking at what I call the two-factor theory of self-esteem. Feeling good and doing good. Doing good so you feel good, feeling good so you do good. It's when you have both parts of that definition that you're going to be on solid ground. And so what the book does is help people look at their own value system. What does it mean to do good? Different cultures, religions, families have different ideas of that. We all have a value system, whether or not we can quite name it. And how do we respond to that value system in our everyday life? And it's really not as complicated as all this highfalutin talk may seem because people do good for one another all the time. And just holding doors for people is a way to say, yeah, I care enough about other people to hold the door when somebody's struggling, you know?
And I agree. One of the things that you put in here, which I think is very true, and this is something that I really try to practice in my own life, is that one of the things to do to help you feel better about yourself is, you call it random acts of kindness.
Yeah.
And, for instance, I know that last year and the year before, I just took $100 and I bought 100 pairs of stretch gloves from the dollar store. And when I would see people freezing at the bus stops, I would stop and just give them a pair of gloves and tell them, here, this is for you. And, I mean, they were so shocked and so surprised, but so thankful.
Right.
And I like to call that my random act of kindness each year, you know, with the gloves, because I know that when I used to be out there waiting for buses before I had a car, how much, you know, my hands would be freezing when it was freezing cold. And even though people were so appreciative of it, it made me feel good inside that I was helping someone.
Exactly.
And that hopefully that would be returned by them helping someone.
That's right.
Right?
And there was a movie called Pay It Forward. You may remember that, where the premise of it was if you do a kind act for somebody, they're more likely to do a kind act for somebody who's more likely to do a kind act for somebody. And that does send a ripple through our community. And sometimes it even comes back around, but we don't do it for that reason. We do it because it's part of being a good citizen and it's part of acting out our value system. And when we do that,
exactly,
then we do feel good. Then we do feel good.
And when you're kind to people, it should make you feel good about yourself. I know that a lot of times people say to me, oh, you give so much of your time, you give it all, why do you do this? And I always tell them it's a two-way street. It's not just one way. I may be helping you, but it helps me feel good that I'm able to help you. And that's what I believe. You have to put something more into life than you're taking out of it. That's my philosophy. Put a little more in than you're taking out, and the world would be a tremendously better place for everyone, right?
Right, and one of the things I do talk about in the book, because I hear about it a lot in, from depressed people in my practice, is people say, well, when I feel better, I'll do more. And I said, no, if you start doing more, you're going to feel better. If you wait
exactly.
until you feel better to do more, you could wait forever. So someday I'm going to make a pillow, one of those cross-stitch pillows, and on one side it's going to say, the less you do, the less you're going to do. And the other side is to say, the more you do, the more you'll feel like doing. That's just a basic truth, that even if you don't feel like it, I mean, I hate to quote the Nike ad, but just do it. Just do it. Do something, anything that contributes in some way to your community, to other people, what you're calling random acts of kindness, absolutely. And by doing even very, very small things, you'll start building up that reservoir of good feeling that's going to help you move out of your depression or out of your anxiety. So instead of waiting until you feel better to start taking action, I really believe that we need to help people and support people in starting to take some action, both for themselves and other people. And one of the things I'm sure you find is that women who get very depressed start just neglecting themselves. They don't do it. Excuse me. They don't eat right. They don't get enough sleep. They don't exercise, and then they look in the mirror and they say, "Gee, I look horrible," and feel even worse about themselves. And it's the same thing.
And you bring this up in the book that you have a son, you know, who works at, you know, who does at the gym, you know, that he does private work there, as far as helping people in the gym, and that when they come into him and they don't look good, you know, then he works with them a little bit. And, you know, what do they call that? Not a coach, but I'm trying to think. I'm sorry.
He's a personal trainer.
Personal trainer, right.
Yeah.
That when he does personal training with them, even if they come in not feeling good, after he does things with them, then they feel good about themselves. And
because
you take it from a great approach.
An hour with him. It's not easy to go to a gym for the first time. Let's acknowledge that. But if you're feeling flabby and you're feeling out of shape, and now you go into one of these gyms and all these especially young people who are so fit are on the other treadmills, it's hard to keep it up. But what my son is so good at is saying, look, everybody has their own journey. You just started. Feel good about yourself. You're here. And I say the same thing to people who come for therapy. I understand that this was really, really hard to do. But give yourself credit for making the appointment. That was your first step.
One of the great things that you do in your book, you have assessment tools. For instance, you have this one, mindlessness self-assessment, which, you know, helps you as far as activity choices for increasing mindfulness. You know, you have all these different exercises that people can do using a mantra, tune into what already is. And even things like meditation, you take a holistic approach that, you know, it's not just a matter of doing good deeds, but it's a matter of exercising, eating mindfully, taking good care of your body, meditation. And it's a whole matter of a whole list of steps here that you can do, that they're all kind of interlocked together to make you feel better.
What I want to emphasize, Bonnie, excuse me, is that this is not a recipe book that if you do every exercise in the book, you'll feel better. What I really worked hard to do was to give people enough choices that they could make a very individualized plan for themselves. And the last part of the book says, okay, there are, I don't even know how many activities are in this book, but now go back and find the ones that you can resonate with, that feel comfortable for you. It doesn't matter. These are suggestions. If you've got better suggestions, by all means, do it. But here's the thing. We have a mythology in our culture that in 28 days you're going to feel better if you go to rehab. Well, it's now been found that 28 days is not enough to change negative patterns in our lives. We need at least 3 months in order to not only break an old habit, but put other habits in motion. So what I ask people to do is, okay, now make a plan, and can you give yourself the gift of saying, I'm going to give this my best effort for 3 months. And if you do, you are likely to be successful. It's sort of like you're not going to lose 20 pounds by being on a diet for a week, right? And you are not going to develop a wonderful sense of self and self-esteem if you're coming from a position of vulnerability and feeling terrible. That's not going to get fixed in 2 or 3 weeks. But if you start taking some of those small steps, doing some of the things that I suggest or that you have learned from other sources, and you make a commitment to yourself that, okay, I'm going to give this 3 months and then I'll re-up, or not, but I'm going to give it an honest few months, then chances are you're going to feel much better.
Can you just address one thing before, you know, I think it's so important for people who are in our situation that you have in your book, and I think it really hits the crux. It's really difficult for people to let go of toxic relationships and connections, and especially when it's within their families. Because a lot of times, you know, I always say that I had to divorce my father, quote unquote, many years ago because it was really toxic. You know, my father was really a very bad father. And, you know, I could make excuses for him. He came from a bad family. And, you know, I tried to understand him. But when it finally overtook my life so much that I couldn't function, I had to finally just say, this is it. I can't let somebody keep knocking me down to the ground, whether it's a father, you know, of course, in a marriage, but also a parent. I have women who have mothers who are very narcissistic, fathers who are very controlling. So it is hard with family relationships, but you can do it and not have to feel bad about it, right?
Absolutely. And, of course, you've just opened up a topic that we could talk about for another couple of hours. It's easier said than done. But I will share one image with you that might be helpful. If you lock yourself out of the house, how many times do you shake the doorknob before you decide that's probably not going to work? And the same thing is true about toxic families. And it's very similar to toxic marital relationships, Bonnie. How many times do you try to make it better and realize it's going nowhere before you say, I guess I have to do something else? And it's something else. That, again, opens up another whole conversation. But often enough, the something else is give it up and put your energy somewhere else where it's going to pay off.
Well, I can't believe that our hour is already over, and I would like to give people, of course, I know, I'm hoping, I'm praying that maybe you'll come back in another few months so we can continue this, because I just love having you here. Site, you can see that Dr. Walker has her website at mariehartwell-walker.com. She's also very visible throughout the Internet, Facebook page, correct?
I'm also a feature writer for psychcentral.com, where I'm also one of the therapists who answers questions from all over the world. There's an Ask the Therapist feature, which is an advice column, and there's a team of four of us who answer people's questions. So I do not answer questions on my own website for confidentiality reasons, but I do on Psych Central. So that's another resource for people.
Okay, and like I say, I'll write about it in our upcoming newsletter so you can read more on how to get the book. Marie, thank you so much for being part of our show tonight and being a bright spot in my life. And hopefully we'll talk again soon.
Good.
All right, good night, everybody. Love to you all.
Good night.
Good night now.